Who presents it?
Improv Mafia.
Improv Mafia presents.
And time! The opinions expressed on End Time do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Improv Mafia, but just because I'm wholly accountable for my actions isn't going to stop me. Welcome to End Time, a podcast for improvisers and aspiring improvisers. I'm Dan Beeston, Improv Mafia's second in command.
And I'm Luke Allen, aka Big Sexy Smoker Toker Midnight Joker. Is that the lyrics?
It doesn't matter whether they are or not, that's what you are.
Yes, you know, some people call me Maurice. Woo.
It has been a very long time since I got onto the mics.
Months.
Months. I got caught up in doing a real play, like a real actor, which I'm sure all improvisers have heard at some point in their life. I actually had someone come up to me after a show at Prognosis Death and go, oh, I liked what you were doing in the improv. When are you going to try a real play? No part of like irony or cynicism in her voice. When are you going to do something of value, though?
Was that my parents? Because my parents have had that conversation with me after seeing an improv show. We liked what you did. When are you going to start taking it seriously?
Well, we're getting paid now.
Yes.
The players are getting paid. We're professional improvisers now.
And it's look, it's good too. I think it's something that you kind of can hang your hat on and say, without a doubt, I'm an improviser.
Yep.
I actually get paid to do this.
Yes. And the moment we started getting paid, you said, I don't want to be involved in this show anymore. I'd like to only be around the rookie show. Are you scared?
No.
Worried you've got to step up to the plate now?
Oh, God, no. In actual fact, on you know, the first time I performed at the Albion show, which is the one we're talking about, I had a really, really good time. Had a fantastic time. I thought I played well, but regardless if I did or I didn't, I thoroughly enjoyed the experience. The problem that I had with Albion, and the reason why the money's not worth it for me, is that each week you're battling 300 to 400 audience members who don't know anything
like
about
you.
Improv. Yes. And take a good while to warm up. And so for me, the money would be nice, but I quite enjoy the very warm audience we have at the Speakeasy in terms of just being able to perform improv there. And I also enjoy the challenges of the arts theatre shows. So for the time being, Albion's not really my bag at the moment.
You should try it now. We don't have to warm up the audience.
Because we have
magicians. Two magicians doing 45 minutes for the first half, and then we get up and we're the headliner act.
Now, are the magicians all dressed? Are they the old school style magicians, or are they
style? They're these action magicians who fast for 30 days and set pets on fire.
David
and
Blaine-esque.
Stuff. Quite frankly, there's not enough pulling rabbits out of hats for my like. There's lots of the audience laughing and enjoying themselves too much for my liking. Proper, in fact, quite frankly, go back to the old school days, which involved the magician like plucking the heart out of a virgin and curing polio, making lots of fish.
I think you're confusing magicians with possibly the Son of God.
That is an easy mistake to make.
So
why I continue to do so willfully.
That'd be fantastic, though, if you are watching the magicians from stage and you actually bought into what they're doing at Albion, that it's completely real. Like, you're just applauding.
There's some guy in the front going, holy shit! Holy shit! Those rings were separate! Two rings! He made them link together!
Or like, you know, you're calling the police as he saws a woman in half and then just drops the phone. He says, he's not reconnected. You know, that's been a oh my God!
Oh, goodness.
Well, how did we get on this? Let's get back onto topic.
Yeah. Why don't we start talking about some of the improv that we've missed in the last couple of months? Because there have been a couple of nice shows going on at the Arts Theatre.
Yeah, we've had two different shows.
Yep, we had the Enid Blyton show.
By the book. Enid Blyton. Which, for those who haven't seen either the Enid Blyton or the Jane Austen version, is what we do is we take a particular writer and then boil down the style of their writings and then put on a play similar to, I guess, the main themes of their books or their style of writing. So we did a Jane Austen, which was very similar to Pride and Prejudice, but had other elements and characters peppered through it. And we then did an Enid Blyton by the book in February. Is it February or February?
February. It's kind of a half silent R.
Yeah.
February.
So I say a W. February.
That's when Wabbit season starts.
Wabbit season. So we had the Enid Blyton by the book.
Yep.
February.
Now, unlike a normal improvised show, this one had a certain extra element to bring chaos to the stage.
It did. I think going into it, Nat, who directed the show,
mm-hmm.
said we're going to bring six of the finest improvisers together and also then put a dog on stage.
She did. She went to a friend and got their border collie, I think, or some sort of
collie. Yeah, no, it was border collie.
Border collie.
Yeah.
Got a pocket full of sausage and got up on stage.
Two thick, long sticks of Cabana was what kept that dog under control. Look, it was a fun show.
And apparently the dog was really well behaved in all of the rehearsals. Did mm-hmm. exactly what everyone expected it to do.
Yes.
And was easy to move around. And I wasn't in the show, and I came along, and I was looking for basically Charlie the Wonder Dog on stage, where the dog just didn't do anything without being forced to do it.
Mm.
And I was rewarded in spades.
Your cup was overflowing.
That's oh, my God.
It was one of those things where in rehearsal we'd said, because the Arts has the stage, and then mm-hmm. you have some stairs that connect the stage into the audience.
Yep.
And we'd kind of tossed around the idea of maybe removing the stairs
mm-hmm.
so that the dog wouldn't leap off stage.
Mm-hmm.
And during rehearsals, that wasn't an issue.
No, because nothing interesting in the audience then.
Yeah.
There wasn't, say, 60 people
yes.
that the dog had never met before.
You know, wonderful scents and smells and that he hadn't come across. So during the play, he wandered up the stairs and down the stairs. So then we decided we'll get rid of the stairs and that we have to stay on stage. So then he decides to jump off the stairs. it was a prima donna performance.
I love you, like, it's a dog. Like, it's a domesticated animal that was born of, like, the species of wolf.
Yeah.
He's not going to jump up off a 3-foot ledge.
No.
Poor fucker will kill himself. No, he's more sensible than that.
Yeah. But look, I think as performers, we knew going into it that it wasn't going to be...
easy to predict what he was going to do.
Yes. You know, we always knew going into that was going to be the case. We knew there was going to be a Charlie the Wonder Dog element to it. And when there was, I think everyone performed admirably in trying to both justify and accept the dog's offers on stage. It was a fun night.
Oh, I laughed hard at that. He ran out the front door at one point.
He did.
I couldn't get him to stay on stage. I love Charlie.
But that was, you know, that was a fun show. And we had some new faces or rarely seen faces at the Arts Theatre. Alicia Wiedemann was mm-hmm. performing with us that night.
Yep. Greg in very short shorts.
Oh, yes, Greg in short shorts. Liam played a constable. It was a fun show. I wish I could say more about it, but it was 2 months ago now. And I haven't.
Yes. We've got another show to catch up on, too. Mm-hmm. This is one I have heard very little about. It's Tall Tales, which was Alex Reichardt's play.
Yeah, yeah. Show. This was, for me, now Dave and I have differing opinions on this.
Yes.
Dave Massingham, long-time improviser with Improv Mafia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to give you the rundown of what Tall Tales was, when Alex originally pitched the idea, what it would be three friends in a hotel room passing the time by telling urban legend style stories to each other.
Yep.
And I think that, and he'd tell you this as well, is mm-hmm. that he was influenced strongly by the show Supernatural, which has had those elements turning urban legends into these and incorporating them into their horror style or supernatural theme storylines in that TV show.
Is this like the film Urban Legend?
Not quite. No, no.
No?
No.
Better?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Jeez, that film sucked.
I barely remember that one. The guy with the hook?
It was just... No. That was I Know What You Did Last Summer.
This is Pacey. Pacey from Dawson's Creek was in that one?
Oh, could be. But basically, it was every single urban legend that you've ever heard. And it was a guy murdering people using urban legends. But the problem is that all of these stories about urban legends require these gigantic coincidences to happen.
Mm.
So the one coincidence in the urban legend makes it an interesting story.
Yeah.
But the fact that every single death had to rely on this ridiculous coincidence, it was insane. For instance, the one where the woman jumps out of the gas station and then she doesn't trust the guy at the gas station. Then she runs back into the car without paying and the guy runs out yelling at her and she drives away and she thinks she's safe from the psychopathic guy who... attempts a thing. But the only reason he was yelling at her was because he saw the axe wielding maniac in the back.
In the back.
And you're like, okay, the story's interesting because this person didn't look in the back. But most people will like notice an axe wielding maniac in the back of their car.
Yes.
Like, that's the twist. Oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
And then the
bar. I vaguely remember that movie. I'm pretty sure I saw it because at the time that was the in thing. There was obviously Scream, I Know What You Did Last Summer, Urban Legend, and other movies of that ilk.
Hmm. Or the one where the girl goes back to her room and she accidentally activates the Polaroid camera or something.
This is starting to sound like a porno. Is this?
No, she's creeping around in the dark,
yeah.
hoping that she doesn't wake up her friend.
Mm.
And then she accidentally activates a camera with a flash. And then she gets out and leaves and comes back the next day and her friend's been murdered. And she finds the photograph of the killer and her friend holding his hand over her mouth. And you're like, oh, wow, what a horrible story. But you can't set that up.
Yeah.
You can't prepare for that to have a character who turns up and just doesn't turn the light on.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's say he removed the light bulb. Mm. How long was he sitting there holding his hand over the girl's
exactly.
mouth?
You exactly.
Know? 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 45 minutes?
That's a lot of preparation.
Yeah. Preparation, which we did for Tall Tales. How's that for...
Nice.
Moving back on the topic. So the original idea for it, of the Tall Tales show, and then the actual final product, obviously...
Yep.
Changed quite a bit during rehearsal period.
Bastardized.
I think we moved
ruined.
Away.
It was ruined on its way.
No. Because I'm actually a huge supporter of this format now. Mm-hmm. It was Alex's idea and show structure.
Yep.
It's something that would lend itself to be done in many different styles. And I'm sure in actual fact, it has been done by many different improv troupes yep. over the years. And, you know, we've just stumbled onto this ground. So I don't think that we're breaking new ground in terms of this particular format.
Mm-hmm.
It's been done before elsewhere. But what Alex did when he brought it to us is, I think it was a show that wasn't going to rely on laughs and gags or over-the-top settings. It was originally going to be genre-based. So mm-hmm. telling those urban legend genre stories.
Oh, yeah.
And those kind of things. And at some point during rehearsals, we diverged from that and decided that we were going to do different types of stories. So Dave was going to do a horror story.
Mm-hmm.
Mike was going to do a romance story. And I would do a travel story, those hilarious hijink travel stories, or even those
road movie.
Like it could be a road movie, or it could be, you know, Bangkok Hilton, whereby
okay.
on a holiday gotcha. People get, you know. But it was, so we took the original idea of urban legends and then distilled it down to genres.
Yep.
And then came through with that. Look, on the night, I don't think we hit the highs that we were capable of. But mm-hmm. I think we put on a solid show. But where Dave and I depart from is that both during rehearsals and on the night, my favorite part of the show was actually the setting up the original location. So three friends coming into a hotel.
Oh, okay.
The banter between those three friends while they tell leading up to telling the story.
Mm.
And then at times, the interjections between those friends during the storytelling.
All right.
Now, that for me felt very real and very loose. And very real, I mean, I've known Dave and Mike now for going on 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've played together regularly, performed together regularly, both in Improv Mafia and obviously the Sexy Detective Sketch Comedy Group.
TM.
So I was looking for, and particularly coming from Prognosis Death in January, and then the stylized shows that we've done in terms of Enid Blyton and Jane Austen.
Yep.
I was looking to play a more honest performance.
Yeah.
And so I very much enjoyed the looseness and banter of the setting up the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And Dave absolutely hated it.
All right.
So it's funny that you have two improvisers with completely opposite points of view in that regard. Because I thought, as I said, I was looking for an honest portrayal. I felt that we were honestly portraying how friends would react, stuck in a hotel room, shooting the shit and giving each other shit during the story.
And it allows you to more easily bring an element of truth to your performance.
Yes.
Which is something that audiences do bond to and find very interesting.
Yes, most definitely. I mean, the one thing I think, once again, coming out of Prog Death for the third time, is that the style of playing that we do in Prog Death...
Sounds like you've got an agenda to push. When are we going to start talking about how wonderful Prognosis Death was, Dan?
Well, I just, you know, the style of playing we do in Prog Death could be defined as being quite soap opera-ish, you know?
Would be.
Well, is.
Would have to be defined as melodrama.
Yes. It's melodramatic. It's over the top. There's a lot of exposition whereby, in a real world situation, you wouldn't perform like that. And in other impro games or impro styles, you wouldn't perform like that. But I'd done a lot of that recently. Felt like I was performing in certain genre styles. So for the opportunity to play honestly and, you know, at the top of my intelligence in those certain settings, I relished. Dave thought we were too loose, and in rehearsals we certainly were. We certainly were. But on the night, I thought we hit a nice balance between knowing what, when you hit the stage, we need to set the scene of where we're at, what we're doing there, and lead up to, okay, well, now we're going to tell a story. So we still had something to accomplish at the end of that first scene. But in between that, we could just be three friends playing as three friends. So I enjoyed that. Dave, not so much. You know, what can you do?
All right. Well, that sounds like that show went off quite well.
It did. And as I said, I really enjoyed the format. I like the structure. I like the scaffolding. And you could take the exact same format, three friends telling stories stuck in a hotel room, and you could make it into a horror play in the style of, say, the Mr. Fish that was performed at the Improv Festival 2 years ago, Derek Flores' show.
Yep.
So you could do three people telling horror stories around a campfire. You could have three businessmen telling about their...
Telling stories at a liquid lunch.
Yes. The basic scaffolding is the same, but you can tell an infinite number of stories.
It sounds to me a bit like a Harold.
Yes, but without the wankiness.
Really?
Yes. Look, I think the thing that people always see with improv is you either see a Harold or you see a Theodore Swartz show. And those are the two real main kind of globally accepted formats. And so obviously when we do a storytelling-based show, it's probably going to be borrowing more from the structure of a Harold than it would be of theatre sports. But I don't think we can say that this show was a Harold. No, but yeah. Actually, here's something. So, I mean, since we've last done a podcast...
Yes.
Impromafia members, though, while we have the monthly arts theatre show,
yep.
have also been engaging in other activities. Yes. I think as an improviser, if you have interests outside of impro, it can only make you a better, stronger improviser.
Yeah.
So I think off the top of my head, you were in a dramatic play, Catch 22.
Yes, I was in Catch 22.
And the...
Which Greg directed.
Greg and Nat,
I think we mentioned this last time. There's a bunch of improvisers in there. So.
Yeah, and Greg and Nat, you know, very strong ties to the arts theatre. And
yes, well, Nat's all in the middle of doing Tasmanian Bays Fiasco, which I urge you to check out because it's extremely funny. Very, very.
But the skills that you have, say, from or hone through a theatre performance can also then bleed into your own pro performance.
Yes, yes. Well, that's why I did Catch 22. Wade actually suggested that I should do a scripted play.
Take some time off from improv.
He said I should learn the piano accordion. Apparently that takes years.
Yeah.
I can't do anything else while I'm learning it.
Yep.
No, he said that anyone can benefit from doing a scripted play because there's a whole bunch of skills that we need for improv, but we don't necessarily practice for improv. But you do that when you're rehearsing a play and you're thinking about blocking and thinking about exactly where you should be moving to make the best performance possible. And I learned all sorts of stuff doing the play, so it was really, really helpful.
Well, we had, I think, five improvisers also take part in the Raw Comedy Festival.
Yes.
So we had Mike Skills. Dimas, Dave Massingham, Tom Lynch.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He got through to the quarterfinals or semifinals for Brisbane.
Nice.
Along with Mike. Joel Gilmore, the Renaissance man.
Yep.
I mean, Joel is someone who is... He's got a PhD or a doctor or at least something with the word science and someone's signature on it.
There's a whole bunch of letters after that man's name.
Yes. He has appeared on the television show The Shack.
On The Shack.
As Dr. Joel.
Yep.
He's given performance...
Not very imaginative name, if you ask
no,
me.
No, really. I mean, as an improviser.
Come on.
He's given talks or presentations.
He never did one show as a pirate.
No, really.
Disgusting.
But he's given presentations at TEDx, the localized version of the TED conferences.
He did a talk about cooking the other day out at UQ.
He's done presentations at UQ. Yeah. So, I mean, and he is a fantastic singer, which we know from his appearance in One Bride.
Yep.
And a talented improviser. I mean, I've told him this to his face and I've used different words behind his back, but he's a Renaissance man.
A Renaissance man.
Yeah. So I think having
those... You know what women don't like being called?
What's that?
Rubenesque.
Really?
Yeah.
When did that go out of fashion?
I don't know, but I would have thought that would have been a wonderful compliment. This black eye says differently.
Rubenesque is one of those things. It was during the Middle Ages, wasn't it? You would always have a Rubenesque
model?
No.
Rubenesque was later than that. That was during the Renaissance and such, I think.
Okay. I must be mixing up my Middle Ages and Renaissance. When were they? Probably 200 years
ago. Well, the Middle Ages came after the Dark Ages, is that right?
So that's the 1500s?
Oh, hang on now. You see, we need Nat.
Yeah.
Or Wade. Maybe the Middle Ages was... I would have thought the Middle Ages... Oh, God. I would have thought the Middle Ages would be in the middle.
Yeah.
That's my historical know-how.
And, you know,
maybe
but
the Renaissance
some point, though,
turned the Dark Ages off. Isn't that the whole point of the Renaissance?
Yes.
Is that
yes.
It was Dark Ages and then
and
the
then Renaissance which
people
was
came
white
and went,
and
yeah,
whatever.
And full of poems and
but the funny thing about the Middle Ages being in the middle...
Oh, God.
Oh, Rubenesque.
Rubenesque chicks.
At some point, they would have been...
Women! Fuck! Ladies, this podcast is over.
Burn this one. But no, actually, going back to also having outside interests. So if you do have a knowledge of history, which Dan and I do not.
We do not.
You know, you can play a genre scene, a location, add specific truths to your character or the location. Now, the audience doesn't have to know it, understand it, accept it. It doesn't even have to
but
register with
it gives you
them.
The confidence to sell it on stage. When an audience sees you confident about something, they believe that you know what you're talking about.
Exactly.
And sometimes you just can't fake that.
Exactly.
But as hard as you try.
So if you can put a historically accurate reference to tyrant dictator in China in 3 AD.
Now, I've been talking to Nat about this because Nat has a bee in her bonnet that improvisers just don't appreciate local news enough. That every improviser should desperately listen to and watch the news. And then she's horrified when people don't listen to the news. And my thing is that people have certain interests, and that if everyone brings varied interests to the table, then you should be good. But improvisers should be interested in something, some sort of pop culture something. Like, I couldn't bring any information about Pop Idol. to the table.
Yeah. Look, any outside interests that can pepper your performance or pepper your playing style, I think, is a wonderful thing. Mm. So going back to outside activities, being in a play, trying your hand at stand-up comedy, reading that historical...
So you said five people.
Well, and then I realised there were only four.
All right. Yeah. So it wasn't you.
No, it wasn't. I didn't try out this year.
No? So. Why not?
I don't have a point of view to talk from.
All right. So I'm not a very interesting
I'm
person.
Not. Look, I cannot talk. Look, it's just not my thing at this point in time. Maybe next year. But, you know, so all those things, any outside interests, and even as Nat said, taking interest in current affairs and current events could be great in front of an Albion audience, being able to and throw in a suggestion that happened that day.
Indeed, it turns out that it's really, really useful, because Nat had a big complaint at me the other week, and I had to grudgingly accept the fact that she was right on all counts. And so what we've decided to do before each Albion show is, instead of just sitting down and talking about Doctor Who for half an hour to warm ourselves up, we've got to sit down and talk about to each other about all the stuff we've learned in the last week. And oh my God, it came in handy. Like, it was really, really useful stuff to have at the top of our brains. Good fun. So Mike got into the semi-finals.
Mike,
doing some sort of... Like, he didn't have a prepared show either, like a prepared bit.
No, not at all. No,
just went up and just chatted to the audience or something.
He had... Now, I didn't see his first performance. I only saw his second performance. And by all accounts, and Michael tell you this himself, that the first performance was far more successful. And I think probably going back to that old impro thing whereby if something works the first time and you try to recapture it the second time, it's never successful.
No.
And so he'll probably say this, and I hope he doesn't take it the wrong way, but I think he'll probably also say that there was elements of that to the second performance, that things that had worked the first time didn't work the second time. Which, though, I mean, that's stand-up comedy. You hone and rehearse, and not necessarily rehearse, but you hone your pieces after a number of different nights of doing the same thing.
Yeah.
But he was kind of doing... He wasn't doing an anti-comedy. He was doing an anti-stand-up comedy in many ways.
Oh, yeah.
So it was fun. It would have benefited if he'd been later in the show so that people's expectations could have been met by the first five or six comedians. This is the box that we think stand-up comedy is, and all of a sudden you have Mike kicking down the door of what that would be.
Oh, right.
But when you come on second and you are such a juxtaposition to everything else... It's not necessarily going to work. No. So, but he would tell you that himself.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. I'll talk to him about that.
But I mean, and you've done stand-up in the past.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, Mike may have failed, but he didn't fail as well as I failed. Woo-wee!
But it's also one of those things that whereby, my hat's off to anyone who tries it.
The stupid thing is I'm thinking about getting back into it.
Yeah?
Yeah. I'm following stand-up comedians on Twitter, and I'm hearing about you guys going into Roar, and I'm like, oh, gosh, maybe I can get back on that old pony.
You know what the great thing about stand-up comedy, too, is, though, is that if you want to do it, and you're in a capital city, if you want to do it, there are probably at least half a dozen pubs which will do an open mic night.
Yeah.
If you want to do impro... You need to find other people who want to do impro. You need to have your own location.
Yep.
You might need to do what we did for a number of years, which is bring our own stage and lights.
Upstairs.
Bump them in and out for each show.
Yep. Or hire a venue.
Oh,
it could be a really... We're very lucky to be in the position we're in at the moment. Hmm. And that's after a decade of work to get everything together. So, we should get on to this week's topic.
All right.
This week's topic is mime.
Huzzah!
The skill of mime and the game of mime and how mime works on an impro stage.
I might take your lead on this. So if you want to lead the conversation, I'll just, I'm not, as most people would know, a terrific physical player.
I'm always amazed at just how terrified so many people are of mime, because I never think of myself as a particularly wordy player. Like, I tend to rely on my physical...
I know an impro company who would agree with you too there, Dan, but anyway.
An entire impro company?
Well, not naming names. Impro Mafia.
And but I find it so easy to fall into that position, to imagine that the location I'm trying to picture in my head is there, and memorizing it all and being able to navigate around it. And it seems like such an easy skill to do, and yet everyone else shies away from it. So I find it quite fascinating.
Well, we did a workshop with Liam Amore 3 years ago, and he did a terrific exercise in terms of setting up your location and mime and physicality. And I guess what I took from that was probably not the big mime elements, like I'm in a car, or this is my pitch perfect Marceau. Wee. You don't have to be at that level to be a good mime in impro. If you can realistically portray that you're sweeping a floor and that the broomstick handle is a solid object and not one of those pool noodles, that's probably enough to get you through in terms of that. If you can grab a cup, put yourself a drink and put the bottle back on the shelf where you picked it up from.
Yeah, well, the hardest thing with that sort of stuff is to, on the spur of the moment, you go, oh, I've got to make a cup of tea. Oh, that involves a cup and a pot. And then you start that moment and suddenly you're like, it probably involves a kitchen too.
Yes.
Like cupboards to take the cup out of and the tea. And I've probably just jumped halfway through what could be quite an effective mime because I'm already pouring tea and there's so much to do before you pour tea.
And also that it depends on, I mean, you could come up with that idea and then decide to play, well, that was the start of the scene. I already had the cup in my hand. Moving forward, as you realize, well, I'd have to be in a kitchen. So here's my kitchen bench. And then continue to paint the picture on from there. But, I mean, if halfway through a scene, all of a sudden you've got a cup in your hand, probably your mime's not where it should be.
I think it relates to just not committing to the mime because you're too busy thinking about the story or thinking about how you're interacting with other players.
Mm-hmm.
And so people will mime something and then they'll just drop stuff.
Yes.
They'll have a cup in their hand and they go, I don't need this cup anymore, and they'll just let go. And they won't think about what they do in a real situation like that. And an audience will really appreciate that sort of stuff.
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely. Because you're building the reality for them. You're giving them another reason to invest in what they're watching.
And that's what a lot of improv is creating a reality for the audience to enjoy.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you can do the physical part of that, you're halfway there.
Yeah. And it's also, I mean, little mime things. So instead of miming a gun by holding your fingers out, actually mime holding a gun. Instead of talking into your pinky finger and your thumb as a telephone, hold a phone or a mobile phone to your head.
And little tiny things like so many mobile phones have that sort of fold down thing.
Yeah.
So if you can fold that thing down, people can spot that, then they're going to envisage that phone much more effectively than if you're talking into your finger.
Yes.
So you don't Marvel. Like inspect a gadget.
Yeah.
So it seems that we agree. So podcast over.
Well, are there little things that perhaps an improviser can focus on besting, you know?
Well, it comes down to listening with your eyes, I reckon.
Mm-hmm.
The other player is making mimes themselves. They'll walk into a room and they may not realize it, but they're actually defining where the doorway is or where the bench is.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can remember that sort of stuff, then when you deal with their mime, the audience will like it. Every time you mime something to the audience, it's a promise to the audience.
Yeah.
And if you or someone else in the scene breaks that promise, if you're in a car and then someone walks through the hood of the car, then the audience on some level acknowledges that a promise has been broken to them.
Yes.
So you should be watching what other people create on stage and interacting within it.
I think when people think of mime, they also think of, first they think of Marcel Marceau.
Yes.
But in terms of an improv scene, they also do think of, well, I have to mime holding a glass, or I'm going to mime doing an umbrella.
Yep.
But there are little things. If you're standing normally in a scene, in many ways you're also miming how high a ceiling is. So if you're not stooped, then if you're standing normally, you're in a certain sized room.
Yeah.
Those kind of things. If you're standing normally, then you're also not miming that it's cold inside. So it's those little things as well that you could do, rubbing your arms or your shoulders to indicate that it's a bit cool. Stooping a little bit because you're in a cave with a slanted roof. Those kind of things to continue to build a location. Attention to detail. And it doesn't have to be, you don't have to focus on every single element or the whole way through.
Yeah.
Give yourself a little bit of scaffolding so that you know where your walls are, where your chair is.
Did you have an idea in your head of what the dean's office looked like in Prognosis Death?
I did, but it was from the very first season. I'd established that. He had a table. He was in an ivory room. He had a painting of himself on the wall. And he had a table at the front, which just so also happened to be where we used to put the bed. So I didn't really have to mind that.
No. We had to mime that it was a table, not a bed.
Yes, that was pretty much it. What about you with Lestrange's office?
Yes, I had an idea it was Lestrange's office. Lestrange's office had a sort of an island in the middle of it, which sometimes was there and sometimes was not. And all of the big refrigeration units for the bodies were down stage left, and then stage right was where the sinks were and the cupboards above it and where he kept the sugar.
Now, so, how much of that, as another player, do I need to know? And how much is it that you just need to know?
I would create these elements as I needed them, I guess. I knew what would be in, and so I started to create them. But the odd thing was that for some reason in my head, I knew that there was only one entrance to the place.
Yeah.
Like there was a door on one side and that door could be locked.
Mm-hmm.
Or they never seemed to be. And the other side was obviously some sort of, there was an enclave there or a cupboard or something there, which didn't really come in useful, except at one point where for some reason I tried to exit that side of stage and then for some reason realized that there was no exit over there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that was quite fun because I realized it, vocalized it, and then the audience realized what I was doing as well. Mm-hmm. It was fun.
And it's one of those things like moving away from Prog Death.
Yep.
But if I've set up a scene whereby I'm in a nice little bed and breakfast,
mm-hmm.
and you and I are doing the scene together, we can agree on the size of the bed. We can agree on where we've put our luggage.
Yep.
But in my head, if I'm imagining daisies on the court cover,
mm-hmm.
But you're seeing something completely different, you know, that level of detail we don't need to know because we've agreed on the basics.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in terms of mime, if you're miming a gun and you see in your hand a Glock and I see a Desert Eagle, those are the only ones I could pull. I
can't believe these are the problems we have to deal with.
But I guess what I'm saying is that so long as you've successfully mimed the object, I know what it is.
Mm.
It doesn't matter if we're a little askew in the details.
Yeah. The other thing is blocking the other person, which can be interesting because sometimes you'll mime something without naming it.
Mm-hmm.
Like you'll hold out what is obviously a gun to the audience, and then the other improviser will accept that it's something else that's not dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And I always worry that that's a bit of a block.
I guess it depends on where it's coming from.
Yeah.
Like, was the object...
Accident,
yes. Yeah. Was the object specifically mimed and accepted as a gun? In which case, yes, someone's blocked you. Like, mm-hmm. And not in terms of, you might think that you've successfully mimed this object as a gun.
Yeah, well, that's the problem, isn't it?
But the other person might not. But, you know, if everyone can understand that what you have in your hand is a gun, then when they start, you know, petting a kitten, it's a bit of a block. Perhaps.
It makes me angry.
Perhaps.
Angry.
Unless they really pat that kitten well, you know.
Then shoot the kitten.
Sharing mimed objects. Yeah. So that if you've already established...
But not mimed needles.
No. No, never. Because you could get mime AIDS.
You could get mime AIDS.
Which is terrible. I mean, that's the biggest killer out there. for both mime men and mime women.
But I heard it was mime homosexuals who really suffered from that. I heard that mime...
That
God.
Is backwards 80s thinking, Dan. If you've established the heft, the weight, the size of an object, then I should
I should be supporting it. If you accept it well and you accept the same weight, the audience is going to love that stuff.
Yes,
because as I said before, you're fulfilling the promise that you've made to them,
mm-hmm.
about the object.
You're yes-anding their physical mime,
yeah.
in the same way that you would yes-and a verbal offer.
Yes.
So I think the secret to good mime is what?
Watch closely, mm-hmm. and commit to it. Like everything in improv, it's about commitment. If you don't commit to the fact that you've got a cup and you've got something to, you need to do something with it,
mm-hmm.
then you're in all sorts of trouble. You are going to have to interact with stuff in a mime. So if you're holding a box and you want to put it down, consider what you've got to put it down on.
Yeah.
And if you need to, bend all the way down to put it down on the floor.
Yes, with your knees, not with your back.
Yes. You'll get a mime injury.
Yeah.
A real injury.
But you know what? The other thing that I want to mention about mime...
Yes?
...is that you don't have to mime the bottle with a screw top. You don't have to mime the way that someone... that you've seen someone else mime,
mm-hmm.
pour an object. At the end of the day, you're still doing your mime. You don't want to be a photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy. You might want to open the bottle because it's a champagne bottle. You might want to have popped the cork,
yep.
from something. It doesn't have to be the exact same mime that you've seen someone else
you
do.
You don't have to do it quickly.
Yeah.
That's the thing. You can take your time with mime and people will appreciate it.
Have
all
a conversation
the more.
While you're pouring something or while you're
or
opening something.
Or do every
something.
Step one part at a time so you're concentrating on it. You can concentrate on a simple activity and people will find it fascinating because there's no actual object there.
Yeah.
They will appreciate the skill with which you do it.
Yeah.
You don't have to rush through anything that you're doing. I also like it when people fail in a mime, mm-hmm. so far as the best demonstration I can remember is when Rowan Atkinson has done a very famous sketch show called Rowan Atkinson Live.
Yeah.
And there was this wonderful one where Angus Deakin was explaining how you should act on a first date.
Mm-hmm.
And Rowan Atkinson is sitting in a car and does off his seatbelt and then does a scene in the car and then tries to get out of the car and is stuck in the car and then realizes that he's forgotten undo his seatbelt,
yep.
takes it off,
yep.
and then gets out of the car. It's genius. It's absolutely brilliant because his commitment to the mime has actually prevented him from doing something in the scene.
Yep.
And he's had to overcome that.
Yep.
And it's that sort of commitment that can really make things fun.
Definitely, definitely. And he's also a very physical performer, Rowan Atkinson. You know, both on a micro level in his face, and then, you know, through his whole body in setting a scene.
But for instance, your scene where you have to crouch to get in there.
Yeah.
Like if you were in that scene and you stood up, you'd bang your head.
Yes.
And people go, "Oh my God, that's right. The ceiling's really low." And look, he's banged himself. Like he's accidentally injured himself. On the mind that only exists in his head.
Yes, but they'll buy it. They will buy it.
And they'll lap it up.
Little things. Next time you're on stage, open a window. Next time you're on stage, do the washing up. You know? You don't have... going back to the old things, you don't have to be pouring something. You don't have to be drinking something. In everyday... There are 1,001 everyday items that you interact with every single day. Mm. And yet we only ever see probably 3 of those on an improv stage. Why is that? Go and mime something.
Hey, that mimed bar is not going to have spills wiped up by itself.
I mean, the amount of mime cigarettes I've seen on stage. from people who don't even smoke. you know, there's 101 things you could do to improve your mime in little ways. And the first thing you have to do is actually mime something.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Buy into it, what you're doing. And ideally, if you have someone off stage who can then tell you, you know what, I really enjoyed what you did, blah. And maybe just focus on, you know, this. Stand in front of a mirror. Hold a hairbrush and brush your hair and work out how you actually, you know, how you hold that object, how your wrist turns as I imagine, you know, I'm balding. I don't brush my hair. But if I did have long, luxurious locks, I would imagine that, you know, as my hand went to the nape of my neck.
Now, I know that there's a certain stigma behind this, but have you ever considered a comb over?
No. It's not that bad that it needs a comb over, does it, Dan?
Well, no, but as you say, balding.
Yes.
That means that there's a retreat on the go.
See, I would think it's barely perceptible at this moment.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
No, but you know, it's one of those things. If you have a mirror, which everyone does.
Everyone's got a mirror, if they're an improviser.
Watch, yes. Pick up an everyday object and watch how you actually handle it and watch what you do with it. It's a very inexpensive way to improve on one aspect of your performance, which adds so much detail and depth to your work on stage.
Now, your only danger when it comes to miming stuff, even if you take a long time or like really do pay a lot of attention to the mime, another player will come on and they may not have picked up on it, and then they will make a vocal decision about what's happening in the scene that may deny your mime.
Yeah.
And that's sometimes that's okay.
That's okay.
Because once they name it, then it's named and you then get to justify what the hell you were doing with it.
Yes. Yes.
Which can be quite fun.
You know, so long as they're not doing it for base of they were completely not paying attention, so that's why they're coming on.
Well, sometimes they're going to be doing that.
And sometimes they're going to be doing that, but as an improviser, you can either then justify what they're doing and justify what you've done and go from there.
But it can be a bit tricky because you think you've defined, and you probably have defined in the audience, like the audience will have picked up on what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
If someone comes in and names it, I've very rarely seen it work where the character's gone, no, I was sweeping the floor with this. It's not a dinosaur at all.
Yeah.
The more effective way to deal with that is to go, yes, it's a very thin dinosaur. Yeah, figure out exactly how you... I mean, it's fun to do.
Yeah.
And the audience will appreciate it.
Yeah. Going back to Tall Tales for a second.
Yes.
Which you might want to cut this and move it earlier in the
face. Someone out. Yeah.
Chris Anderson, in his blog, Musical Hotspot.
Yes.
Which can be found at musicalhotspot.com.
Yep.
Mentioned that he'd gone and seen Tall Tales, and he was talking about how, for that particular performance, we didn't actually have any music in the show. I should post this on his blog, actually, but he was sitting watching the show, viewing through the eyes of a typical audience member, rather than as he normally does, which is as the musician sitting to the stage right. And going back to Tall Tales, one of the things which I think would have helped Tall Tales is if we had a musician.
Yeah.
Not for everything. What we want to do is establish the reality of the scene as the three friends enter the hotel room.
Mm-hmm.
But then as they go into each story that they tell, because that's a story inside the story.
Yeah.
During the stories that they tell, that's where I think that we could have benefited from having Chris.
Yeah, well, or any of the other musicians. One was a horror and one was another one. I mean, the music would be able to differentiate each part or each genre-based thing.
Yes.
It would be another cue for the audience to pick up on. I find it very strange that there was a decision to not have a musician in a show. I don't know whether I've ever seen a show where not having a musician is better than having a musician.
Yeah, but look, I'm not sure if maybe there was a scheduling conflict.
Maybe that's what happened.
Yeah, Yeah, it could be as simple as that. But for the next, because I'm so high on this format,
yeah,
the next time we do it, I would love to have, regardless of whether or not I'm in it or not, I would love to have a musician. Because I think having the musician playing a flourish to add pathos or the emotion or heighten the tension, whatever it is, but also give the audio cue to the audience as to, this is the, you know, because we're dealing with juggling three stories.
Yeah, this is the change.
This is the change. Now we're into this story.
Yeah,
you know,
and this is the genre we're changing to.
Exactly. So that was something that I would love to see. The tall tales.
I reckon we just blame Chris.
Yeah, yeah.
For not forcing his way in there, Chris. What the hell?
I think
you were desperately needed up there, and you were just pissing around in the audience.
Yeah,
you're a dead man.
We saw him too. You know, he was miming a piano, rubbing it in our faces.
And every time he'd go back to that exact spot.
Exact same, yeah.
Because he was concentrating, he was committing to that mind piano.
Exactly.
What have we got coming up?
Coming up, we've got Worst Side Story. The second musical. Worst Side Story, Michael Griffin, director. Luke Rimmelswan, vocal director.
Oh, yep.
And then a cast of unknowns at this moment. I'm not sure if Mike's settled on his cast yet.
Oh, God. Isn't it like 2 weeks out?
I think it's 3 weeks, Dan.
3 weeks out.
I think it's three.
3 weeks.
But that's coming up next month. So that should be fun. Worst Side Story. Obviously, we're playing off West Side Story.
I'm not familiar with that.
In the same way that One Bride for Seven Brothers was...
Seven Brides for Seven Brothers,
yes. So we're visiting the star-struck lovers theme of West Side Story.
West Side Story, it's basically Romeo and Juliet, but with click fighting, right?
Essentially, yeah.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, I like it.
So going over that ground...
Except I can't click.
Yeah?
No, can't click my fingers.
Maybe you can click your tongue at the same... Mime clicking your thumbs.
Well, I learned what that is. That's called a nap.
What is?
Making a sound to make one sound look like another sound. Oh. So that's something I learned at the theatre, is that... I could throw a punch with my left hand, so it goes past someone's face, but then surreptitiously slap my thigh like that, and at the same time, and it looks like you've cracked them one.
Yeah.
And I'm going to do that all the time in impro now.
Well, that's just professional wrestling, really. You know, throwing a punch and stopping your foot.
What? No. Yeah. No, but the wrestling... No. Well, what I'm saying is you're acting in this.
Yeah, just like professional wrestling.
No. In professional wrestling, they punch each other.
And slap the thigh.
No. They don't need to because they're punching the guy really hard in the face.
Now, are we talking women's wrestling or men's wrestling?
All wrestling.
Right. We need to have a conversation.
Except for that Greco-Roman shit. Yeah. God, that's so unbelievable. And time! You have been listening to Luke Allen. Luke Allen is part of the Sexy Detective Sketch Comedy Group. You can find it at thesexydetective.com.
Yes.
And they never update the site.
No, we have been busy doing shows since January. So impro shows, not Sexy D shows. But you know, you'll see some updates coming through both on the sexydetective.com website and on our YouTube channel, which you should subscribe to.
I'm Dan Beeston. You can catch up with my blissfully unpopular comic, InvisibleSpiders.com. For news on impro in Brisbane, go to ImproMafia.com. Thanks to David Peachy for our theme music. Hosting for Antime is diligently provided by CivicNet Web Design.
That's such a tiny mouse.
Beg you to leave personal insults to mine. Keep them to yourself. Wade says that we should call ourselves an impro... Company? An improv company, because a troupe is full of monkeys.
Oh, okay.
I've jury-rigged that stand to put my Latin drum block on.
Oh, okay.
Thinking of bandaging a drumstick to my foot so that I can start that one-man band thing.
Well, you're looking to become Dick Van Dyke from Mary Poppins, really.
That's the goal. Like, that's the height.
That's the gold medal, really.
Yeah.
That's the gold standard.
So far, I've got the guitar and a harmonica around, but not... attached to my neck, so and a little drum that I can do with my feet. So I'm hoping to be able to get the big bass drum on the back with the pulleys and then the cymbals and my knees. But I mean, that's a long way in the future.
Yeah,
I've got to learn how to do it first.
Yeah.